You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Between how a movie looks, sounds, and how it's put together, there's a lot of work that goes into making a film. And when it all goes well, it's a seamless experience for us, the viewers. But if you've ever wanted to dig deeper and learn how to watch a film like an expert, this conversation is for you. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is Associate Professor of English and Director of Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She talked earlier this fall with WPR's J. Carlisle Larson.
We're talking about movies and specifically what separates maybe a casual movie viewer from a film buff.
Yeah, I think the thing that separates a casual viewer from a film buff, you can really boil it down to passion, right? Like, you don't have to have absolute skills and total, you know, an abundance of degrees in order to love film. You just need to come to it with a passion. That said, it can be useful to have some basic ideas of how film functions in order to get a bit deeper into your analysis.
Well, let's talk about some of those functions because, you know, sometimes I sit down, watch a movie, hit play, watch it, and then I'm done. And maybe I don't think about it anymore. So what are some of those functions and how can people maybe bring them into their practice a little?
There's absolutely no problem with sitting down and just enjoying something and turning your head off for a little bit, because I do that too, right? We all do that. And there's no shame. You know, I always say there's no guilty pleasure. There's just pleasure. But I think that having access to some of these different kinds of ideas about how film works can increase your pleasure. It can actually be a different kind of pleasure in movie watching. The first thing we all come to movies with is narrative, right? That's generally the first thing we think about, is how movies tell a story. And that's a great place to start. So the first place I often recommend that people look is, how is the story told? Whose perspective is the story told from? Are we following one main character? Are we following multiple characters? Do we get a sense that we have a kind of objective perspective, or is there a subjective one? All of these are ways that we think about storytelling that really come from literature to a large extent. So that's the first place that I recommend we start. We start at storytelling and at character. But film is not literature. That's really important to stress. It's not literature. It's something completely different. It's something that's made up of images and sounds and very, very detailed and careful structure that is made by an entire group of people. It's one of the really wonderful things about film. So what I also then recommend looking at as we move from narrative, which is kind of like the first level, as we start to kind of excavate into what film means, there's four major elements of film form that I recommend we take a look at. The first one would be mise-en-scène, which is a fancy French way of saying everything that's contained in the frame. So that's everything from lighting to costuming to sets and settings, even to the actors themselves. So like everything you see in the frame, that's mise-en-scène. So pay attention to what's in the mise-en-scène. That gives you a sense of how the larger story world operates. The next thing I recommend looking at is sound. And well, I guess you'd be hearing sound, right? So the next thing I recommend paying attention to is sound. How is the sound constructed? How are people talking? What kinds of sounds are you hearing? How is the music used? The next element we look at is cinematography. And cinematography is, of course, camera work. How the camera's moving, what we see via the lens of the camera, which really functions as our eyes on the scene. And finally, the last thing I would recommend that we look at in order to watch movies like a movie buff is editing. And that can be the most difficult one to consider, because most films are edited so that we don't notice how the editing functions. Most films use what we call invisible editing. And that's because editing serves to suture the story together and make sense. So that can be the hardest one to look at, but that's the kind of fourth level of excavating film form for thinking about movies like a movie buff.
So, Jocelyn, let's work backwards then with these examples, with these terms, because you just were talking about editing and how it's supposed to be invisible. You're not supposed to see it, but there are examples in the broader cinematic world where you can see these edits. One of the films that comes to mind is Godard's Breathless, which is a very strange film to watch if you've only seen movies that are maybe by American directors or American editors. Can you talk a little bit about that film? Because it was kind of groundbreaking.
Yeah, that's a great example, JC, because when that came out, it is in large part the editing that was so shocking to audiences. Of course, that's probably the most famous film coming out of the French New Wave. And the French New Wave was often deliberately provocative. What directors like Godard wanted to do was break apart what they saw as a very kind of like machine-made approach to filmmaking in general. So in something like Breathless, you'll see a lot of use of what we might call jump cuts. And jump cuts are when, I mean, you know it when you see it, right? You know a jump cut when you see it. It's when the camera angle changes, but the mise-en-scene, i.e. whatever's in the frame, does not. Or it's when the mise-en-scene changes, and the camera angle does not. And it effectively serves to kind of shock the audience a little bit because it doesn't function like a normally edited conversation or scene might function. Now, how this works then for Godard is that it calls our attention to the fact that we're actually watching a movie. We're not just immersed. We're not just swept up in the storyline. Instead, we're reminded over and over and over again that we are watching a thing that is being constructed in front of our eyes. And that's what Godard wanted to have happen. He wanted to break that immersion that the audience experiences in order to make a larger political point.
We are talking to Jocelyn Sapania-Galise, Associate Professor of English and Director of Film Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And right now we are talking about how people can watch movies like a film buff or a film expert. And we are going over right now some of the terminology. And we just talked about editing. And moving backwards, I want to talk about cinematography because, as you said, the cinematographer is basically our eyes on what is happening in this film. Can you talk a little bit about maybe how cinematography has evolved over time?
Absolutely. I mean, it's such a kind of massive element of film form. In some ways, it's kind of like the most fundamental because it involves working with the camera. Early on in the history of film, the camera tends to be more static, more stable, and then various kinds of technologies make it possible for the camera to move around, tracks, eventually things like zoom lenses in the mid-century become something that's much more widespread. So cinematography and the things that can be done with the camera really do shift over time in terms of how mobile the camera is, and thus how mobile we are today. It's not uncommon to see drone shots especially in like openings of films, right? And that would have been really staggering for even a cinematographer in the 70s to see. But when we think about cinematography, one of the things that I think is most important to think about is not just what we see in the frame, but what the cinematographer and the camera crew have chosen to leave out of the frame, right? We get this sense often that like, oh, we get this really expansive view, whatever. What is almost as important as what's there is what's left out, because that gives us insight into what we're supposed to focus our attention on, and as well as what the wider world of the film might be if we had more to see beyond what is in the frame.
And I guess in that vein, do you have any films that are at the top of your list that you think are just excellent examples of cinematography?
Absolutely. One of my favorite films to talk about and to teach when I teach cinematography is John Frankenheimer's film Seconds from 1966. It stars Rock Hudson. It's really, really an incredible film. It's kind of like a scary psychological science fiction drama about a man who gets the option to completely get rid of the life that he has and enter a new life entirely. And the way that it's done is that he has this this really massive kind of plastic surgery and bodily overhaul, and then enters into an entirely new life, where he's now played by Rock Hudson, right? So he gets very handsome and young, of course, as he makes this kind of transformation. The film is shot by James Wong Ho, who was one of one of the most prestigious cinematographers in the American mid-century, really, really fabulous cinematographer. And what's so amazing about the cinematography in this film is that it kind of changes as the film goes on. So when we get this emergence of the main character into the body of Rock Hudson, the cinematography starts to get kind of canted, right? So that means that a canted angle is when the camera is kind of off kilter. It's also referred to as a Dutch angle. So it's like, we don't have like a perfectly stable image. Instead, everything is kind of shifted over to one side or the other. And what that does when we're watching this film is that it gives the audience the experience that they have entered into a body that's not their own as well. So it's kind of like the style of the cinematography is embodying the experience of the main character. There's a couple scenes where he gets like totally plastered drunk with all of his friends. And in those moments, the cinematography tends to be much more handheld. It tends to be really jerky. And we similarly get this experience of feeling really nauseated, really drunk. And it's all done via the way that James Wong Ho shoots the film. It's really, really incredible.
We're learning how to watch movies like a film expert. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies from UW-Milwaukee is our guest, talking with WPR's J. Carlisle Larson. More to come in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're learning what to watch for in movies that can help us think like a film expert. UW-Milwaukee professor Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is our guest. Here's the rest of her conversation with J. Carlisle Larson.
So Jocelyn, we've been talking about the visuals of film, but let's talk about the sound of film. People obviously are aware of scoring and soundtracks, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but I want to talk about the natural sound that comes up in films and what people should be listening for in films, because there's a lot going on with sound that we aren't aware of as viewers.
Absolutely. And we can think of sound as a kind of counterpart to cinematography, because sound also implies not just what we hear, but what we're not hearing. So sound can be used to reduce what we're hearing in accordance with the perspective of the character we're following, for example. So one of the most famous examples of this is Francis Ford Coppola's film, The Conversation, from the 1970s. And in this film, which is, it's very, very famous for its creative use of sound. In this film, the main character is following a couple. He's a private investigator who's been hired to kind of follow this couple and find out what's going on with them. And he records their conversations over time and records them outside as they're walking around a park. And he's trying to piece together exactly what's going on with this couple. And the centerpiece of this film, appropriately enough, since it's called The Conversation, is this one conversation that he records where the couple says to one another, he'd kill us if he got the chance. And so the entire film is constructed around what the meaning of this particular sentence is in this particular conversation. As we watch the film, and as we get deeper into the perspective of the main character, we then begin to understand that he has had certain prejudices around how he's hearing this conversation, such that he's interpreted it one way, when at the end, it turns out that he was interpreting it entirely the wrong way. And at that moment, the sound that we hear actually changes. Coppola changes how we've heard that conversation in order to show us that we've only been understanding the story via the lens of this one character. So we've kind of been a bit tricked, right, throughout the course of the film, simply by how the sound has worked.
Let's talk for just a moment about how music plays a role, whether it is composed specifically for the film or, you know, borrowing songs from pop culture.
Yeah, music is a major way that filmmakers can inject a lot of emotion into a scene. It's something that, it's also a tool for immersion too, right? Because we get kind of swept away with whatever songs or music that we're hearing. It's important to distinguish between score and soundtrack, as we've talked about before. Score is music that's added after, I mean, all the music is added after, but score is something that is composed specifically for the film. And it refers to music that the characters are not hearing, right? Score is not supposed to be something that we think that those who exist in the film world are experiencing. Instead, it's something that only the audience experiences. And it's then put into various scenes in order to kind of amp up that emotional tension. Soundtrack, on the other hand, can be something that characters are hearing. It also might be something they're not hearing. It just depends on the particular scene or on the particular film. A soundtrack is often like pop songs or songs with lyrics, things like that, that might help set, they might help set like a scene in history, right? They might give us insight into a chronology, a moment in time, or they might also be used to create some kind of like emotional catharsis. So I always like to think about Paul Thomas Anderson when we're thinking about soundtrack, because in many examples, especially in his earlier films, he uses soundtrack to kind of confuse that line between whether the audience is only hearing a song or whether we're supposed to think the characters are hearing it as well. So in something like Boogie Nights, in the opening of Boogie Nights, he uses the song Best of My Love to bring us into this club scene that's happening in the 1970s, like in a disco in the 1970s. And we see characters dancing as the song is playing, but we also hear the song continuously as we enter into the club. So it's a really wonderful example of how you can use soundtrack to immerse audiences into what's happening on screen, but also to kind of question whether we're experiencing exactly the same thing that the characters are or not.
Can we talk just a moment again about a film that had maybe the best scoring?
Sure. There's so many that have such amazing score, but one of the ones that I like to talk about that's a bit more recent is Arrival, Denis Villeneuve's Arrival, which I actually just taught in the spring for sound with my undergrads. And I think this score is so fantastic in that film because it really integrates with a larger theme around communication. And it can be hard to distinguish in that film what is score and what is sound effect. And that's one of the things that I really, really love about it. In Arrival, of course, the humans are attempting to communicate with aliens who have landed on Earth, and they don't have the same language. They're trying to figure out how to communicate with beings that have a language that is completely foreign to any possible human language on Earth. And it's coupled, this attempt to communicate is coupled with these very kind of deep and reverberating kind of clangs, these very, very powerful sounds that are almost metallic. And the score comes in and integrates with that in a way that makes these larger sort of inhuman booms and very kind of ominous sounds into something gentler and even a little bit sublime. So I love how that film approaches how we can integrate both sound effect and score.
We are talking right now to Jocelyn Sapaniak-Galis. She is an associate professor of English and the director of film studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we are talking about how people can watch films like a film buff or a film critic. So Jocelyn, one thing I'm curious about is after we've gone through a few examples, we've gone over these terms, but for people out there that are curious about, you know, maybe getting outside of their comfort zone a little bit, given all the stuff we talked about, is there a movie or two that you might recommend that people sit down and watch with all of this in mind?
Yeah. I think it's a really excellent idea to push yourself a little bit, because that's really how we learn, right? It's by challenging ourselves that we begin to understand the kind of wonders of all the possibilities that that film brings to the table. So yeah, there it's hard to choose just one, one or two, but I'll try to come up with a couple. One film that I think it's a little bit harder to find, but if you can find this one, I think it did just start streaming on a couple platforms. It's a film called The Fall by Tarsem Singh. And Tarsem Singh was really well known as a music video director at first. He directed the video for Losing My Religion, the REM video, which is a really, really well-known video for those of us who are ancient as I am.
I love that video, Jocelyn. It's amazing.
You know what I'm talking about. And The Fall was kind of his magnum opus. It comes out in the early 2000s, and it's about a stuntman played by Lee Pace in the 1920s. He's a stuntman for silent films, and he has this terrible accident performing a stunt for one of his films, and then he's stuck in this kind of rehabilitation facility outside of Los Angeles. And while he's there, he meets this little girl who's, she's a member of an immigrant family, and she also has had a fall, and they meet each other in this rehabilitation facility. And he begins to weave this really magical story for her about all of these heroes from different locations around the world who come together to fight this villain and try to save this one, this one kind of princess figure. What's so amazing about this particular film and why it's so useful for kind of integrating all these terms that we're talking about is that Tarsem Singh shot this film all around the world. So there's all these like really fabulous, amazing locations that he uses to craft this fairy tale that's really about the movies. So you can use these kinds of tools that I've mentioned in order to begin to understand how all of these amazing locations from all over the globe come together to tell a story that's really about the wonder of filmmaking. It's very, very colorful. It's very, very kind of expansive, and it uses music in really wonderful ways and has pretty incredible cinematography as well.
Well, Jocelyn, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you so much both for your recommendations and for taking us through how to watch films this way.
Thank you so much. It's just always a pleasure.
That was Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies, Director of Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. She talked to WPR's J. Carlisle Larson about how we could watch movies like a film pro. Coming up Monday on Central Time, catch up with the top stories of the week here in Wisconsin and around the world. That's Monday here on Central Time.